I want to kick off this week with talking about HomeKit a little bit more. We talked last week in our mutual rant about the negative changes in HomeKit with tile grouping, no changes there. I still feel as strongly as I did then. And Mayo, I even heard from our pal Michael Stieber. He said he listened to the show, didn't quite get it, and then he looked at the article and then he could just see it, and he's like, how could anyone disagree with that? So
yeah, like the if you can't get it by the words, just look at the screenshots. It's before and after. It's night and day difference.
Yeah, you had a good tweet, which is just like one screenshot and it is like summarizing the whole story.
Yeah, it just doesn't make any sense. And yeah, there's certainly no indications that it's being fixed at the moment.
Yep. But I did want to talk about some cool things coming to HomeKit and the Home app this year, some of which we can use now and then some of which are kind of like future promises. And also just like throughout this year, because HomeKit has had in the first few years of HomeKit, you would measure the improvements by categories expanding. You know, what missing category can now be supported in HomeKit? And They would slowly add categories and then there was, I think like last year, you didn't get a new category, in recent years. It's been funny. But then the beginning of this year, TVs became a thing with AirPlay 2 TVs and then TVs in the Home app. So that's nice. And, even though it's mostly new TVs or TVs from, Vizio in the last few years, but so that's a cool thing with HomeKit. But even this fall or later this year, early next year, we should start seeing two new things that are kind of exciting in terms of categories, which is, HomeKit routers, which we've discussed on the podcast whenever, you know, iOS 13 was brand new. But can you recap what HomeKit routers will be?
Yeah. I think it's slightly exaggerating the impact by its name, if you see what I mean. Like, it sounds cooler than it is. It's mostly a security thing where they're basically, with the firmware on the routers, they will sandbox the communication of all the accessories from each other. So it's mostly about how security. I don't think it's actually going to do much in terms of like a customer experience point of view, really. You'll be able to manage some settings and some configuration from within the Home app, but it's mostly just about like security.
Yeah, and it does address a concern of if, you know, smart home stuff can be creepy, and do you trust these vendors even with HomeKit? And presumably having this level of router that works with HomeKit will
it's especially targeted as if a device was compromised with like a software update, and then it started trying to send back constant data about you, like to an external provider. I think what the HomeKit routers are going to have is basically firewalls per accessory, so they'll only communicate the HomeKit protocols enough for them to function. And so any attempts to like talk to an external server or, you know, some random IP address in China are just never going to get through anywhere. That's the main appeal of the HomeKit routers.
Yeah, I don't know about you, but I'd rather have that than not have that, though.
Yeah, I wouldn't like rush out to change my routers because of it, but it's obviously a nice thing to have on the feature list.
Yeah, and the other thing is the HomeKit secure video, which is definitely way more consumer focused, and that tackles. I mean, it kind of follows the services narrative of Apple lately, but they're adding value to the existing pitch of buy more iCloud storage, because if you have higher tiers of iCloud storage, you can now turn your HomeKit video cameras, many of which we believe are already in the market and that they'll receive firmware updates. We never know till it happens, but, you know, at least Logitech's saying that and some others are saying that. But the idea there is that then you can, we'll describe HomeKit secure video for me.
Yeah. So obviously right now in the Home app, you can watch the live stream and then you can get a notification when something happens. But if you're not there instantaneously, the video stream just carries on. It doesn't save any history. So with HomeKit Secure Video, it will record, it will look out for, it will do more intelligent motion detection, so it can see and distinguish between like people and pets and cars, and then send you direct alerts for those individual things. Plus, it will actually save those snapshots of video for you to go back and look back later. So if you're out at work and then something happens, but you don't get to it immediately, when you go home, you can go back and watch the video because they've saved it on your iCloud account, basically, and you can see exactly what happened during the day. And these kind of features are things that if you have third party, you know, like home security cameras, they charge you subscriptions just to do that, right? To do recording. And so now Apple's offering their own that's bundled into the Echo storage tiers. And so if you're on the $299 Echo storage tier, which is the 200 gigabyte one, you can have recording on one camera. And if you're on the terabyte plan, you get recording on up to five cameras, mm-hmm. essentially. And the actual processing of the video footage to do the detection happens locally on either a home hub, so like an Apple TV or a HomePod, or, you know, one of the iPads that you set up for that purpose. And it's all stored end-to-end encrypted. So it's stored on the server and you can access it from all your devices, but, you know, Apple can access it if they wanted to.
Right. Yeah. So that's something to look forward to. And then even now, like, there are subtle things, like in the home app, you'll have things like way more options for assigning icons. We discussed this last week. But that makes such a big difference in personalizing everything in the home app and making it more glanceable and reflective of what your home looks like. And then they've also
all the automation stuff.
Yeah, all the automation stuff. That's something I think you're more experienced in, what you can do with shortcuts and then home kit kind of mixing worlds now. What's some stuff that you see possible coming with that?
Yeah, so it's just like, obviously right now you can do automations in home, but they only automate and can control your HomeKit devices, right? Because you go into the tab that says automation, you choose when someone leaves or you choose a time of day as the trigger, and then it lets you activate scenes or change accessories to certain states.
And the last change to that was the ability to automate based on local sunset and sunrise, because there was like the first level of automation in the first year, and then there was finally adding using sunset and sunrise locally if you have a home hub as a trigger, which is great. And there's been nothing since then until this.
Yeah. And so imagine those triggers, but now they can also fire shortcuts, as in all the, like a lot, most of the capabilities that you can do inside of shortcuts, you could do as, you know, HomeKit triggers, and they run on your home hubs, not on your phone. So you can be away from the house with your devices and the automations and the shortcuts still run. So even something as simple as, like, you could have it when a doorbell is pressed, make it play a tune, right? So say if you've got a Bluetooth doorbell that's connected to HomeKit and you have speakers in, you know, another room in your house, and mm-hmm. you want it so that when the doorbell's pressed, it to actually play a sound on the speaker. Well, in current HomeKit, those automations wouldn't let you do that because there'd be no shortcut for making the speaker do something, or making like a light to, or like you could do like a light change color, but you couldn't talk to any external system, right? Whereas now you're getting most of the power of the actual shortcuts app as part of the HomeKit experience, and it just runs on the home hub directly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's kind of cool, because and people are just dreaming about what you could do with expanded automation. One of the things that people often say is, when I arrive home, play a song or a playlist. And that's one of the things where it's kind of cool in theory, but in practice, you know, it would get really old really fast, like having your favorite song be your alarm clock, and that's what you hear when you first wake up. But connecting a HomeKit doorbell to AirPlay 2 speakers throughout your home, like maybe that even enables you to hear the doorbell in like a downstairs basement office that you'd never hear otherwise. So
yeah, or you can go like the other way around and have it, so say if you do workouts at home, you know, like indoors and stuff, mm-hmm. you could make it so, using shortcuts and the automation stuff, where there's one of the options is when you start a workout on your watch. So you could do like a shortcut trigger where it's like, when you start a workout on your watch and you're in the vicinity of your house, change the lights to a different color, start playing music on the speakers, blah, 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 in response to that action. And that was the, you know, those kind of triggers just didn't exist before.
And that's super cool, because I use a HomeKit scene. So a scene is a collection of different accessories, change them to a certain state based on a single command or tap of a button. But the thing is, I use a scene to activate and then another scene to deactivate, and it's all a voice command or a manual button tap. And so what I do is I say, Siri, gym time, to turn off the lights in my office, turn on the Nanoleaf light panels to be like this cool color changing scene, and then turn on the standing floor fan connected to a power outlet, a HomeKit power outlet. And that's all with a voice command. But it's always right before I start a workout on my watch. So it would be very cool and very practical to always do that when I begin a workout at home with my Apple Watch, because I'll only ever be in this area anyway. And then the same thing you can automate when you end the workout to end that state of lights and fan on. And then that would be really cool.
Yeah. And finally in 13, they actually add in AirPlay to speakers as automation actions. So you can do basic stuff like starting a playlist, pausing the music, playing the music, that kind of thing.
Yeah. It's something I like that. And then even super minor things like new background options, you know, they originally had like, one or two or three wallpaper options.
Three that were like actual photographs.
Yeah. And then they took away one of those, which is, I think, one of the nicer ones. And then they got it down to like maybe one image of like, cause there was like green leaves on like a stone wall and there were like red flowers outside, like a, you know, and then they simplified it down to like, just like white vases or something. And they replaced all of that with three colors, yellow, blue, and green, I believe. And then they added this year, or that they will be adding this year, like six or seven different color options with kind of a neat look to it. It's almost like it could be like a motion wallpaper, but it's a still photo or a still image. But I think it's more interesting than just like a gradient, you know, it's got texture to it. Yeah. And then just the variety there, because you can always use your own image. But it's a lot of work to change every background on every version of the home app in your life on every device, and then every room in that case. So it's to get your favorites as the first screen, then all your different rooms. So it's a lot of work to do that. They don't sync.
Yeah, because they don't synchronize.
Right, exactly. So having a better default out of the box for people, it's a cool plus. And even things like we discussed in passing before, like taking bridges for Philips Hue lights and moving those from a specific room to a setting kind of screen in the app is logical, and we've wanted that before. And then like small things, like just how fluid it is to kind of move around when you expand a tile, you know, some of this stuff is a step backwards, like we discussed last week. But there's also nice things like being able to you know, see what is accessory is included in a scene, and change things like the UI of like a thermostat. And then I'm not sure if we mentioned on this show before, but and setting up new devices with HomeKit and iOS 13, they often recommend that this be a part of a scene that you
might
not
have. Like suggested scene recommendations. So, because that's a big issue when you're first, a lot of the friction with smart home stuff in general is the, you know, getting it installed and getting it set up in the first place. And if you're like, you know, techie or whatever, like us, or you listen to the show, you're not going to have a problem. But if you're like a layperson on the street, you just want to get this thing to work, right? And so now when you're setting up an accessory for the first time, say if you're putting in a light, they can automatically suggest you have this turn off in your good night scene, and you just have one extra like checkbox to make that happen instead of having to set it up separately and go back in there.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And now that I've got that, you know, I feel a little bit better. let's talk about a hashtag ask 95 Mac question that we've got, from our listener CL on Twitter. He asked us both kind of what are the biggest problems with HomeKit? And now that we've had our rant last week about grouping, we're kind of free
so
to
excluding the iOS 13 stuff.
Yeah, excluding that, we can say before that, if that were to be fixed, whatever, this is what it would have been. I'll let you go first here.
Yeah, I still think HomeKit has a lot of problems in different ways, and you know, I don't want to say just there's only one thing left, but for all of HomeKit's like positives, there are a lot of weird edge cases that still need to be sorted out. But if you ask me to pick like what I want them to address next, it for me it would just be like the favorite system at the moment, because basically, with the favorite system, you can show accessories on the main screen that you want to access more frequently, and those accessories also get privileged placement in Control Center, and no third-party app can participate in Control Center as it is today.
Even so if they use the HomeKit API, right?
Yeah, but in Control Center, you can't have third-party widgets of any kind, right? It's only Apple stuff.
Correct.
So the only way, if you want to get like, if you're anywhere in the operating system and you want to see HomeKit stuff, the quickest way is through Control Center, and the only exposure you get that is Apple's home app. And what happens in the home widget is you get to see scenes and you get to see favorite accessories. But the problem with the favorite system as it is today is that, unlike wallpapers, the favorites do synchronize. So every user of your home has the same favorites. And it doesn't quite work out that well. For me, I have my own room in my house, right? So for me, my favorite accessories tend to be the stuff that's in my office. But The rest of the family doesn't care about that stuff. So, but I don't want to favor it because it gets in their way. So we've kind of reached an equilibrium at the moment where the favorites are just like the common shared rooms. Mm-hmm. So like the dining room and the kitchen, that and the living room lights, that kind of stuff. But ideally, I'd like to be able to favorite my office lights and my HomePods and stuff as well. But I just can't do that at the moment. So for me, that's kind of what I'd like them to tackle next, just having per person favorites. So don't synchronize the favorites, let each individual just synchronize it to the user account. So on my phone, iPad and watch, I have my synchronized favorites for me, and then, you know, my parents or whatever can have their own separate list of favorites.
Yeah, I first viewed that behavior as a plus because one person can arrange the favorite screen for everyone without them having to manage it on their own. But that only goes so far, because once people get familiar with it, then you shouldn't assume that they'll never learn how to use the Home app if they're you know, living in a HomeKit home. And so I agree with you. It shouldn't even be a toggle that's too complicated. Just have favorite sync per account, because they know which account it is, you know, so all your devices are in sync, and then each other person can have their own. Because I've totally run into that experience where I want, just say, like, my bedside table lamp to be in my favorites list, but I don't care about, like, my kid's lamp, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
So, totally. For me, it's a category that's missing that I would love to be there, because if I had to tell you, like, What is my favorite smart home device in my life? And I've got lights, I've had garage openers, I've had door locks, ceiling fans, which are really cool. I've had window shades, like all kinds of things. But my favorite thing that gives me like the most joy on a long-term basis is the iRobot Roomba vacuum. Because I've got the Roomba vacuum that has its own bin for emptying what it sucks up into, and then you change that trash bag out every few months. So every time I get an alert on my phone or my watch that says Roomba has finished a job, I'm just delighted. And I'm walking around home and I see the lines in the carpet where I didn't have to vacuum myself, and it did actually a really good job. And I have kids who like to leave crumbs all over the place. And like, you know, you can see a trail. If I lived alone, it'd be another thing. Like the lines would just stay there all the time. But by having kids in the home, it's like things move, you know. The only complaint about having to manage a room with kids is that you do need to do like an initial cleanup of where like small items are, so that you don't have an interruption in Roomba vacuuming and getting stuck somewhere. But there's no support for smart vacuums at all in HomeKit. And it's one of those things where Siri shortcuts has, I think, slowed down Apple's interest in making this happen. And companies who make robot vacuums, you know, push for support in HomeKit, because they'll say, we offer a Siri shortcut in our app. And, you know, that's okay, but it's hacky. It's not as much of HomeKit as like a learning curve. Siri shortcuts for managing a smart home device, that's next level.
Yeah, and they come with loads of downsides. Like you have to have the exact phrase spoken for it to do anything. You can't see the current status in the home app or in the favorites screen. And you can't, you know, like just tap it with your button. There's a lot of like Siri shortcuts are fine, but they're no substitute for the real thing.
Exactly. And I think this could you know, really benefit HomeKit and the Home app. Because right now I use Amazon Echo speakers to do natural language voice commands for controlling the Roomba. You know, I can say, tell Roomba to vacuum, tell Roomba to vacuum the kids' room, tell Roomba to vacuum the living room and kitchen. Like, it knows where the rooms are and everything, and it's really natural language. The best I've done is connecting if this, then that to Roomba's API. And then I've created, we've discussed this on the show before, like natural language commands that are scripted. Like tell Roomba to, I don't even remember what they are anymore, because even in the natural language, they're scripted. So even the most basic ones, if they're, you know, if you're not looking
if you
at
get
them,
one word wrong, it's not going to know what to do.
Right. And I've had that happen. And so I just rely on using Echo speakers to use voice control for the Roomba. But, so on iOS, it's just more convenient to either go into the iRobot app, you know, or to use the buttons on the Roomba, but then you don't get the room control. So, but one of the coolest things about like looking inside of the iRobot app is you can have your Roomba vacuum your home, and then it can create a seriously realistic map. Like if you're looking at like a bird's eye view of your home, you know, ceiling, like roof off.
Plan.
Yeah, exactly. Of your home, you know, and it doesn't know where the walls are if there's a couch in front of it, but it knows that it can't go there. But that's pretty good. And I can look at a pretty good floor plan of my home, thanks to the, you know, Roomba vacuuming. And, there's no concept of rooms in the home app visually like that. It's just like a list of rooms and you swipe between them based on what you name them. But I think we might have even mentioned before, like that would be nice to have in the home app in terms of usability, you know, instead of this, you know, 10 pages of rooms or a list you go through, having a visual floor plan and you like tap which room you want to control. That'd be really cool. So if they did that, they could even say, if you have a robot, it can make a map and it'll work in
it
the
does,
home.
And
map.
It does the map automatically without having to make it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And the, you know, there's things they could do in the future. Like, you know, if your phone is closest to this HomePod that's in that room, then, you know, without even using the HomePod, you know, HomePod knows what room you're in. But it could detect like with your voice, if you're talking to your iPhone, it could know, well, you're close to that HomePod. So you must be in this room. And then you have that same benefit without having to use the HomePod. So one thing could go a long way there.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep. All right. I want to talk about a few things, before we get into the news this week. Mostly things that have been kind of on the backlog and on our notes for a while and clear these out before Apple has any kind of a big event that takes our attention for the rest of the year. The first thing is that it was a review that I have in progress, and it is I'm calling it the ultimate Peloton review, and it's a review of the Peloton stationary bike and treadmill. I own the bike. I'm reviewing on loan the treadmill, and I expect to have a review out mid-September or so. But basically, the angle on this is that they have a digital subscription service with their bike and their treadmill, and the whole pitch of the treadmill, the whole benefit there is that it has a screen and you can do live or on demand fitness classes with classes broadcasted from New York, and they're real trainers and they're really effective in my experience so far. And I'll have a lot more to say in my review. But the angle here is that they do work with HealthKit in their Peloton app on the iPhone and iPad. So there's an Apple connection to that, and you can even integrate your Apple Music in a way that the classes have their own playlist. You don't bring your own music. You could, you know, there's always music playing in a live class. So you're not using your own music, but you can kind of pick what genres of music you have in your class based on the ones that they offer. But you can double tap, like you can favorite a song on a playlist and it'll add it to an Apple Music playlist for you. So there's a connection there. And then, you can, I haven't used their iPad app to AirPlay, but my understanding is that it's one of those apps that's like a first class AirPlay experience where the screen on your iPad isn't just mirrored on the screen of the TV. It's that your iPad becomes like a second display. And then the main thing is on the TV and your iPad shows like your stats and things like that, right? Like, isn't that, it's a thing.
Yeah. It's like being a machine. It puts the numbers nice and big on the external display, and then you have like all the control UI on your phone.
Exactly.
So with like the Peloton app, you can just have like the video stream on the external display, and then all the UI, the Chrome, the maybe the textual steps that you can read on your actual like phone or your iPad.
Mm-hmm. Yep. One thing I have written so far is that because they work with HealthKit, which is kind of a plus, you do need to decide which way you log your workout. So you could just connect a heart rate monitor to your arm. The Peloton bike or treadmill reads that, and then it saves to the activity app, even if you didn't do an Apple Watch workout. And that's nice. But if you do the Apple Watch workout and that, then you get the data, at least appears in the activity app twice, and you can prioritize by manually sorting out your list, which data gets, you know, is like the data. But I don't like that system. So I just have, I think I only use the Peloton app for writing health data with breathing. Because you can do like a yoga or meditation, and then that would count towards your breathing or your mindful minutes in the health app. That's a thing. The other thing I'll mention in my review whenever it's published is that there's no Apple Watch app for Peloton, but they do encourage you in the Peloton digital membership to, you know, run outside. If you've got the treadmill, you like to run indoors, but also you probably like to run outside. And so they have audio classes too. They're not live, but they're on demand. But you've got to bring your iPhone. And so I don't love to do that. Nike's figured out, a lot of people have figured out how to do audio downloads on demand on the watch, you know, during for a workout. And that would be nice if Peloton, you know, brought the watch, you know, had a watch app like that.
Have they announced like GymKit integration or plans or anything?
They haven't. And it's one of those things that they've been around for a few years. They're not brand new. But what I've observed is that if you have like one thing is there was a story in The Verge recently where the first generation screens of the bike weren't going to get software updates anymore because the screens were too old. The processors weren't fast enough to drive the new software experience or whatever, you know. And to replace the screen for a newer system would normally be $750 or so. But if you upgraded from one of those trip bikes, then it was half off that cost. So it was kind of a more reasonable price. But what that tells me is that the screens are upgradable. That stationary bike, this is a stationary bike, nothing too intelligent about it. And the same for the treadmill, but the intelligence is all in the screen. And so my like imagination tells me they could replace the screens in the future with NFC and GymKit could be supported because that's where the computer is. The bike is in the treadmill. They're just hardware.
Yeah. So the bike's like dumb. And then you stick a Peloton iMac on the front of it.
Basically. Yeah. I mean, literally on the tread, it looks like a space gray iMac Pro, but bigger. So it's interesting. A couple of things that I've enjoyed about this so far that I'll also mention in my review is that my daughter, she loves using the treadmill, and this has made her say, "I want an Apple Watch." And it's saying to me, she's too young for one. If the watch could be independent without an iPhone, I would do it in a heartbeat, but I don't think she's ready for an iPhone yet. You know, she's got the new iPod Touch. That's enough. And an iPad, but, the fact that you have to have an iPhone for the Apple Watch makes me tell her, we'll wait a few years on that. But I am kind of maybe going to look around for like a kids oriented fitness tracker since she's enjoying this. But like,
you get a Fitbit Versa thing.
Yeah. I have feelings about that, but we'll see.
I mean, they're not as good as Apple Watches, but if you're
right,
a kid, right, and you just want to, you know, be like daddy, is close. You know, it's reasonably close.
Yeah. What I could do is get like one of those sub-$100 refurbished iPhones and pair it to an Apple Watch and just never have her worry about the iPhone part.
Yeah. Because all the workout stuff can happen phoneless.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And if it was a cellular watch, then it would have all the benefits of like location tracking and everything. Although it's not, I mean, her age is not a concern. She's there at school. She's with us. So, it's something to think about. But I've told her, you know, if you're doing, she likes she can't do the bike yet. She's too short, but she likes the treadmill a lot. And, I love that seeing our family exercise has made her think is totally normal and something to do as well. And I'll tell her you can't go beyond 3 miles per hour on your pace on the machine. And the machine, the treadmill has like this really good interface for like rolling forward, these side knobs for incline and speed. And it's really natural. And I really like that about it. But she's gone like way above what I tell her because she can handle it. And I'm there next to her. I can watch it and make sure she's not going to hurt herself. But I've been really impressed. So I'm happy about that. The other thing about the treadmill bike is that, and my son is 2 years old. And so he's nowhere near, like he has done he's walked on the treadmill. It's got this free mode that turns off the belt, and you hold onto the rails and you move the belt on your own. The motor's off. The belt moves as you move. And he's walked with me with that. But he's way too young to be on the bike at all. And there's no mode like that for the bike. So what we found for his birthday recently is from Fisher Price, and it's like a learning e-cycle sort of thing. It's like a stationary bike.
Yeah.
And I really like this. I will definitely review this soon on 9to5 Mac, like after I get the Peloton review out of the way. But what it is, it's like, it's a kid's stationary bike from Fisher Price that has apps. So it's got Bluetooth on the bike. You connect it to an iPod, an iPad, or the best part is an Apple TV. So they've got 6 apps with different characters on the Apple TV. And so
they have a tvOS app?
They have a tvOS app, and it is so good.
The future of TV is apps.
You pedal on the stationary, you know, kid's bike. And that's how you move your character in the game, and you steer, and you've got different buttons for like acceleration and everything like that. But it's all physical though. And it's, I love that. So I'll find a link for that. I'm not sure what the exact name is for it, but it's a Fisher Price like bike that connects to iPad. And it's
that's hilarious that Fisher Price is like an Apple TV developer.
Yeah. They do one free app, and then the other ones have in-app purchases to unlock the characters or any gameplay at all. And their license are like, SpongeBob and Barbie and some other characters. So it's kind of neat. But I love seeing the family use that because like he's two, he can't get involved with the machinery, but that thing is really cool. And
yeah, that sounds cool.
Yeah. I didn't realize like before we got down this, rabbit hole that there was, you know, a bike that you could ride to power your TV, like an adult version of that wouldn't be so bad. You know, it's kind of the Wii Sports thing all over again. And finally, I want to talk about a creative use of the Voice Memos app on my watch while I'm talking about my kids for this segment.
So new in iOS 13, obviously, the Voice Memos app.
Yeah, new in watchOS 6 on the Apple Watch. is the built-in Voice Memos app, and it syncs to the iPhone, to the iPad, to the Mac. And Voice Memos has been on the iPhone for ages. It is what it is. Like, I've just never needed to use it. Reporters use it when they need to, like, capture a quote for a story or something, but I've never had to do that or anything, so... Voice Memos, I just haven't used. But on the Apple Watch, I just kind of had one day when my hands were busy and I was alone with my son and you know, he's trying to talk to me and everything like the best he can. I thought, you know, I'm going to launch the Voice Memos app on the watch and just let it run. And I found that to be one of the coolest experiences of the watchOS 6 yet. Because if you've got the phone, you've got to carry it with you. Or if it's in your pocket, it might be kind of muffled, you know, but you're thinking about it. And it's like, you've got to, it's like in the front of your mind, I'm recording audio right now on my phone. But on the watch, it goes with you no matter what, unless you take it off. And you kind of forget about it. Like you can let it run for 10, 20 minutes and, you know, you have an indicator on the screen, but you don't have to be in the Voice Memos app. And it just, it's so passive that you kind of have to remember to turn it off if you're just like passively recording audio. And so I found that just tapping that, letting it record, and then just going about my day when I'm with my kids, I'm capturing some really precious memories that are going to be priceless in like 10, 20 years to me. And the analog here is that I know my grandmother used to have tape recordings of like road trips, you know, occasions like that. And I didn't have anything like that, you know, in my experience, even though we've got all this technology, but just the form factor of the watch and just the use case there, it's so neat. And I'm making a habit now of doing those. And it's kind of like, you know, you take a picture, you take a video, those are all very intentional and your hands are there, but to do it on the watch, it's like, you just forget about it. And it's so natural. And in most cases, no one even knows.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense to me. I mean, it's almost like the Snapchat spectacles, which are essentially the same idea where you're just capturing like ad hoc, off-the-cuff snapshots of your life. But obviously that is on your face and it does video as well. And this is essentially the audio-only version of that. And I'm sure down the road when Apple eventually ships their AR glasses, they'll essentially have the same equivalent and you'll just be able to, you know, passively have fun with your family and you get some cool... you know, first person video essentially, and you move on. Like, this is the same thing but for audio, and it's on your wrist, and the microphones in the Apple Watch are surprisingly good. Like, it's a decent quality, and then you can just, even if you don't listen for 10 years, it doesn't matter, they'll just save in iCloud. You can go and get them eventually. Just nice little memories.
That's right. And I know the next time I go see my grandma, like, she always has life stories to share, I'm definitely going to fire it up and just not even mention it. And just let it run. So if you're listening and you've got some ideas like that, you know, give it a shot.
Hiring these days just isn't as simple as putting an ad in the newspaper or posting to a job board. With more qualified candidates than ever before and remote work expanding the hiring pool even further, you need something to help you find the right people for your business. When you're juggling the need for new hires with everything else it takes to grow your business, it's important to be able to reach out to the right candidates at the right time. This is where LinkedIn Jobs comes in. Get up and running from the LinkedIn Jobs dashboard. Simply start with your company name, job title, and location. Over 600 million members visit LinkedIn to make connections, learn and grow as professionals, and discover new job opportunities. A hire is made every 8 seconds on the LinkedIn platform. Every 8 seconds, LinkedIn's wide database enables them to put your job post in front of the people with the right academic qualifications and soft skills to meet your role requirements. Education and grades are important, but LinkedIn also considers qualities like collaboration, work ethic, and adaptability. LinkedIn Jobs finds people that are not only qualified, but fit in with your company's culture. LinkedIn does the legwork to find the most qualified candidates so you can focus on hiring the person who will transform your business. With LinkedIn Jobs, you can pay what you want, and the first $50 is on them. Just visit linkedin.com/happyhour. Again, that's linkedin.com/happyhour to get $50 off your first job post. Terms and conditions apply. Thanks to LinkedIn Jobs for sponsoring Happy Hour.
A few more things for me before we jump into the news that I just want to throw out there. The first thing is a super simple tip that I have for AirPods. If you have first gen and second gen, I think by default, what is the behavior like when you have it adds your name.
It puts a hashtag. It puts a hash symbol. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like hashtag number. It's like number two, number sign two with a hashtag two, which is just really clunky. I've done things like take out the hashtag and just have Zach's AirPods 2 because I do have the first generation ones. You know, they're not good enough to sell. They die too soon, and I would never give them to family because it's like, I don't dislike anyone that much. But what I think is kind of cool is the way that Beats has named their headphones over the years, where they do like Power Beats 2, Power Beats 3, and then the numeral, there's no space there. And like, what do you call it when it's like something squared and like the number 2 is up to the right?
Superscript.
Superscript.
Little numbers that go above the normal lines.
Yep. And I'm not totally sure how to do it like just by typing it. I did see like instructions for it and it's never something I'd remember. So my method was to find an example of that online and just copy it and then paste the character when you name your AirPods. And so I've named mine Zach's AirPods Superscript too. And I think it looks really classy.
You do you, and I personally think it looks horrible, but that's
okay. It reminds me as if Beats took over naming of AirPods because they got the same name. And I don't think a lot of people have this problem because you may not have multiples, but if you do, like I know Rambo has like 8 or 10 sets of AirPods for some reason, you know, he does the AirBuddy app and everything. He should really do this, I think. And the last thing is kind of, this will eventually be a story on the 5Mac, but right now I'm on this search for the perfect MacBook Pro charger. That's different from the one that comes in the box. And what got me on this is the GaN chargers where they're super compact and they're fast. So I ordered and received the RavPower USB-C charger. That's GaN. So that's the new technology where it can be super, super compact and have the same speed. So it's like same wattage. It's enough to power the 13 inch MacBook Pro, and I don't think it would. I don't think it's ideal for like the 15 inch, but maybe just slower. But I've got.
And it's literally half the size of the Apple chargers.
Yeah, it's remarkably smaller in footprint. It's kind of like who cares, but the biggest thing about this is that it's black, and it's like okay, so it's smaller. It's new technology that Apple isn't even using yet. So that's neat, and it's black. Okay, I'm sold. Then I had to find a USB cable to go with it, and I usually use the MacBook charger with, I guess, the 6 foot or 2 meter cable, and then I also use the extension cord that used to come with Macs before and don't anymore. I've got a lot of those from those years of like having to replace MagSafe chargers, and you'd keep the long cable that came with it. So I'm used to my charger being super long, and so now I'm on this journey to find the perfect MacBook Pro charger that Apple doesn't make because I want it to be black and I like the small footprint thing. But ideally I'd have the cable be just one thing and not like the brick in the middle of two long cables. So what I've been looking for is what I'm using now is the RavPower brick and then an anchor or anchor, 6 foot USB-C charging cable. And it's black. And I love it because my iPad's black or space gray and the MacBook Pro is space gray. So it's nice to have a black charger for that. But the length is just too short for me that I cannot practically charge and use it in most situations. So I was looking at like, what is the longest USB-C charging cable you can find? Like USB-C on both ends. And I'm okay with it being data only. I don't care about data transfer. In this case, it's my charger, not a data cable, not a Thunderbolt 3 cable. And what I found is that they're hard to find longer than 6 foot, but you can find 10 foot cables. And I think that'd be enough for me. I think that'd be ideal, but they're hard to find. Like the only one I've found so far is from Nomad, and it's one of those braided Kevlar ones.
Oh, yeah.
And those are okay. They're durable, but I don't want anything like gray or like braided nylon. You know, I want it to be just, you know, I guess, what do they call it? PVC? I don't know. But the kind of plasticky, rubbery cables, you know, that are just nothing fancy.
You just want plain cables that are long.
Yeah. And I found that, that Amazon makes one of those for a reasonable, like $17 price in white, silver, which is different, and, gold and gray. But not black. So if anyone knows, I got some suggestions on Twitter, but I just haven't found it yet. Like,
it must exist somewhere.
Surely it exists somewhere.
It's just a power cable.
The closest I've found is braided with the nylon Kevlar stuff, and I don't want that. And it's not even solid black. It's gray, basically, too. But when I find it, it will be a story about the perfect MacBook Pro charger and That's iPad funny. Pro charger. Yeah.
So. Yeah, because speaking of chargers, actually, we talked about this a few months ago now, the Anker PowerCore Fusion thing, which is that it's also a GaN charger, but it's the one that doubles up as a portable battery.
Yeah.
We spoke around the show, right?
Yeah.
At the time, it was only available for US plugs, but a reader actually tweeted at me recently to tell me that they actually stock them in the UK store now, so I'm getting my hands on one of them at some point. So
ooh, that's exciting.
At some point too, yeah.
Yeah, I really I don't think I've even seen the picture of it, but I did a side-by-side of the Apple's brick and then the RavPower brick, and it's so nice. Like, it's a small thing, but like, it's kind of a luxury, but if you can afford, you know, they're not expensive. If you can afford having a spare charger, if you want an extra charger, I think might be the one to go for so far. I just need to find the right cable for it. If you don't need a long one, then the market's huge. But if you want a link to it, you're kind of limited right now. Unless someone knows something I don't know. But let's talk about the news this week too. There's a few things going on that we didn't get that are new from last week. First is both a scoop and a project cancellation and covered by The Information. What's going on there?
Yeah, it's quite rare that the report that something has been cancelled inside Apple is also a report that unveils it existing. The Information had a story this week that an iPhone walkie-talkie feature project had been shelved. And this is pretty sure this is the first we've heard of this project. And basically what it sounds like is that a future iPhone hardware would include an antenna and radio that communicate on a radio frequency that is not the normal data network or the normal cellular network. And it would essentially be a radio, like a terrestrial radio type frequency, so that people who are in places with low signal strength, like up a mountain or in the desert or something, would be able to contact each other over a longer distance than like AirDrop or Bluetooth, which is like 100 feet, right? So they would essentially have special hardware in them that would allow people to communicate over like miles of distance and essentially be a walkie-talkie. It wasn't clear if it was going to be for calls or just for texts. And that would essentially be the feature. And so I suppose if you're an Outback Explorer, you could both have some iPhones on you and chat from a long distance. But apparently that the person who was like heroing the project inside the company left, and now there's no one there that's really motivated into it at the moment. So it's been shelved and not coming anytime soon. I'm not, personally, the way it's described, I wasn't like, damn, this feature's got away, I'm really sad. Like, it seems a bit like esoteric and very obscure. Like, Apple doesn't normally target the parts of the world that don't have data connectivity, right? Like, all of their devices are very much expect you to have Wi-Fi, expect you to have mobile data, and we're quickly coming up on the 5G developments and all that expansion. A feature that essentially lets you go off the grid is kind of anti everything that they do. So personally, I'm not really surprised at this, but it is kind of funny that, you know, we heard about it through its apparent reported cancellation.
Yeah. I mean, that one of the interesting things, like, you know, because of what you said, is the way that the story was picked up in the news, and most headlines that I saw of the story, you know, being picked up, seemed like it kind of assumed everyone knew about it and that the cancellation was the story, but like, nah, it really was a scoop and a story about the thing not happening, which is kind of rare. I think you could, I don't know, we're too far removed from what was going on, but it did sound like something novel that you don't see otherwise. You know, people made the connection to like Nextel, you know, the chirp phones before, the way to communicate between those phones. But I could see it being like, if you're, you know, like some privacy angle to it, you know, maybe where your messages, if you're in the vicinity, like if you're in the same, like you're working together or you're in your house or you're in a classroom, you could communicate messages directly to each other without ever going over the network. So there's a privacy angle to that. And then if you step back from privacy a little bit, you could even do something like, you know, I know when I drive with Waze, you can see other Waze drivers and, on the road. And, you know,
but when you're on the road, you have data.
Yeah.
Why you can see it on Waze.
Right. But similar to how AirDrop works, you can see other people around you with permission. You know, AirDrop, the control there is that you can expose yourself to, everyone or just contacts. And so the same control could apply here where you could, like if you're in a crowded, you know, you're in an airport, in a bar or something, I don't know, but if you wanted to open up yourself to communication with people nearby, that chat would be an option. The use cases could vary, but it did sound novel to me as like a new way, a fun, different way of communicating that isn't over the network. If it was just about network connectivity, I think it'd be very limited.
The problem you have in the modern world is that say if you can text someone from 10 miles away, right? Okay.
Yeah.
But realistically, what else are you going to do with your phone? Like the internet empowers you with so much stuff and so many services and connects you to the world. Like being able to do, you know, 10 mile texting, it just is still pretty limiting in the scheme of things. Like the future of the world is not essentially walkie-talkie radios. It's more like a Google project of where they were, you know, hanging 5G modems off like balloons that they were floating in the sky. Like that kind of thing is where you kind of see society going in general, so that we can get mobile data coverage to the mountains or the deserts. Like those places that currently have no internet connectivity, to me it just seems like the logical route is to find ways to put up masts or to put up other ways to get internet to those places, rather than like, oh, here's this thing where you can text someone, but you both need the phone and you both need to be in range. You know, it just feels like a very pre-2000s technology.
Do we know where the person left Apple to go to? We can watch to see where this idea comes to next.
Yeah, someone else goes and does it. It was kind of funny because they said that the radio technology was a collaboration between Apple and Intel. And, well, we know how the Intel relationship has also soured so much in the past few months, but they did acquire everyone, so maybe maybe someone from the Intel acquisition will be really hyped about this thing and get it going again.
Yeah, it's like the new BBM, but it's like the limitation isn't having a BBM in your PIN code, but having an iPhone and being in proximity. I mean, you're probably mostly right. That is not the future. Let's talk about some news about Siri. So one is an improvement to Siri and one's a development with Siri. So what's going on with Siri this week?
Yeah, this might be like the first public Siri feature that you can maybe associate to John Giandrea, who obviously joined the company last year and is now SVP. Essentially, Apple is now exposing a smarter way to answer Siri questions than just having to fall back to the website. Because whether you think Siri is the best thing in the world or it needs work or it's terrible, that like the meme, the thing that's closely associated to it is, here's what I found on the web for, blah, and you just get 5 Google search results, right? Like, that experience is clearly suboptimal for a voice assistant. And what Giandrea kind of pioneered with Google is the knowledge graph kind of approach to data organization and kind of quote-unquote learning, and that powers a lot of the Google Assistant stuff nowadays. So when you're asking questions that aren't just like basic stats. So obviously, if you ask Siri, what is the highest mountain in the world? It can tell you, because since iOS 11, they've been kind of crawling a database of essentially Wikipedia and getting all those stats information from there and collaborating together and amalgamating it into the thing. So if you ask Siri, what is the tallest mountain in the world? It can come back and tell you it's Mount Everest according to Wikipedia, and here's the fact card about it. It's this web answers thing, which is currently in testing and presumably rolled out at some point, is an extension of that. So they're essentially trying to answer not philosophical questions, but questions that don't have like statistical answers, with something more impressive and more direct than here's 5 search results. So the example is like, how long does it take to get to the moon? Well, that's a subjective question with lots of like, you could have one stat for it, which is the distance, but the web answer result actually gives you a kind of, it sounds like a human answering, because it will say the trip to the moon took just over 3 days. Or if you asked Siri, like, how long does a check take to clear? It can reply with this web answer of, checks typically take 2 to 3 business days to clear, right? And those formulations sound like intelligence, because it's like, oh, Siri's being really clever. It's formulating this sentence, which is a direct answer to my question. If you actually like digging at all, what you find is that, you know, they're just quoting parts of websites, right? Like, and you can even click through and it will take you to the source website. That sentence, that checks typically take 2 to 3 days, business days to clear, is found on this website. And the intelligence of the service is that essentially Apple stroke Siri, the Siri backend, is crawling all of these websites now and finding ways where if there is a direct answer to a question, it can put 2 and 2 together and present it to you. And a lot of the comparisons to Google Assistant are on exactly these type of questions, because Google Assistant's very good at this kind of trivia stuff because they have this massive treasure trove of the Google search engine and the refinements. It's like when you go into Google search and you type something in and you don't get 10 links, you get the little box which directly quotes like an answer to what you've typed in. Is that equivalent, but for Siri, and they're also doing it in Spotlight as well. And to me, this is very much like a Giandri feature. I mean, it didn't exist last year, for sure. And obviously, Giandri started at the beginning of last year. And one of the things he's most well-known for at Google was pioneering the knowledge graph in the first place. So,
right.
And if they can get it to work, and at the moment it seems to be limited to, you know, relatively subset questions, and it only seems to be in the US. But if they can get it to work well, they'll be able to increase the hit rate of Siri by a fair margin for those questions that aren't about controlling your device or asking the weather.
When you see those comparison tests of Siri, and it's never best at trivia, and they've even said like Siri isn't tuned for trivia. That's not what we do, you know, in comparison to the Echo voice assistant from Amazon. Effectively, it could be, you know, and it's not a knock. Like it's a good thing to have. You know, the faster to the answer you get. And it's not limited to iOS 13, right? This is everywhere. I think I've seen someone on iOS 12 see it in their results too.
Yeah, I think it's just kind of rolling out. And they're testing, because obviously the risk with relying on sites like Wikipedia is that obviously they can be abused and people can write the wrong information down there, and Siri will just spout it out, right? Because it doesn't actually know the answer. It's just doing like algorithms to try and find the right answers, to try and find popular answers to the sentences. And that's why all of these web answers have a little link for report concern. So if they're showing the wrong thing, or they're, you know, spreading false information, you can actually report it.
Yeah. Do you recall what the mess wasn't there a mess up recently where a few months ago where you'd ask about the president and it would show like something you wouldn't want to see?
Yeah, that was a New Year's New Year's Eve, New Year's Day, and essentially someone had hacked the Wikipedia page and changed the image to something very unsavory.
Yeah.
Not safe for work, but you can probably imagine what it was. Mm-hmm. And because when you ask Siri, who is the president, it brings up Donald Trump's Wikipedia card, essentially. All mm-hmm. the all the data is crawled from Wikipedia, so it was also showing this photo. And so there are risks to relying so much on these kind of web answers instead of like empirical sources, but the benefits are also massive because you don't have to have a person typing in all these random questions. You can, if you can get the algorithms right to find the right extracts, you can answer so thousands of questions all in one go and have those be updated as, you know, the web evolves as well.
Mm-hmm. And in iOS 13, they are definitely pushing users through the UI to use the voice assistant more, suggesting you could do this with Siri faster, but they're also even just pushing dictation more. So if it's a search box, like the microphone to dictate a search query is just huge now. And so it's like they want you to use voice, whether it's just to type out text or to actually use Siri a lot more now.
Yeah, they have so many places where they just show little cards that say, you know, you could be in messages typing this out, or you could ask Siri to do it for you. Like, they have so much of that in iOS 13.
Yeah, and we've even seen with CarPlay where I suppose just with Siri in general, that if you respond to a message with Siri, that if the recipient of that message is also on iOS 13 and that level of software and beyond, that it would have a sent via Siri tag to it.
Yeah, they're definitely raising the profile to try and increase usage of it, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. That's interesting. And then so there's the podcast transcription stuff. That's happening now too, Rob.
Yeah, this is all kind of, I don't know if this is just like coincidence of timing or if it's actually like a concerted effort by them to start these kind of initiatives. But like with podcast transcription now, they have computers, machine translating pretty much every single audio file that's stored in, that's recorded in the Apple Podcast directory to help with search. So in addition to title and description, they can search in the, what people are saying in the shows, right? Using their dictation services. You can't actually like get access to a transcript as a user, but if you search, it will say like, they said this in this show with a little transcript tag on it.
Some context.
Just imagine like the data processing that's going on for that, right? They're analyzing thousands of hours every day of podcasts to be able to do this relatively minor feature. And we've seen them start the initiatives with real-time lyrics in music. And Q even said that that's something that they're doing with employees, or that, you know, it's probably contractors or whatever, that are essentially building their own database of lyrics. And of course, we have all the map stuff, the Maps 2.0 stuff, where they're building out their own databases there. And all of these kind of like big data projects, I don't know if it's a coincidence or not, but it just seems like stuff that Apple would never even have attempted 3 years ago, right?
I mean,
like, it's a very Googly kind of initiatives, right? That always felt like, oh yeah, that's the kind of thing that Google would do. But now, you know, Apple's doing it as well. And obviously it's good that they are. It's just an interesting thing that I've kind of noticed.
Yeah, I think there was like this I believe it was the D8 conference with all things D turned into Recode, you know, whenever Walt Mossberg and Kara Swisher did the conference, where they would ask about Google and differences between Google and Apple and search specifically. And it might have even been when Siri, it wouldn't have been in the age of Siri because that didn't coincide with Steve Jobs making that appearance. But
what had happened was that Apple had bought, do you remember Siri was like a standalone app before and they acquired it?
Okay.
So essentially they, and it was public news that they bought it out.
Right.
So, but the Siri feature on the phone hadn't shipped, but Apple owned the company Siri, which had a very similar voice assistant app before.
Yeah, and Steve Jobs had this response to the question about like, are you becoming Google?
Are you becoming a search company?
Yeah, and it was very much like that is what Google is great at, and we're not, and so we're going to let them do what they're great at, and we're going to, you know, do what we're great at, and but you could see that answer changing now as like the landscape of, you know, and it was always a Steve Jobs thing to own as much as you can in your product and everything. So you can see his answer evolving now as, you know, as the company it needs to change. So
yeah, Apple's like interest and ability in kind of like internet service infrastructure, like not just high level services like TV and arcade, but mm-hmm. the kind of back end stuff where it's like, okay, you know, we actually have our own Maps database. We're not just going to pull in data from 20 other people, from 20 other providers around the world. We're actually going to do the legwork ourselves and take all these photos and get all this imagery and process all this data. And yes, we're going to transcribe all of these hours and hours of audio. And at the moment, Apple doesn't have like any kind of financial incentive for either Maps or podcasts, right? Like they're essentially free add-ons to the core iPhone service. And then you have the lyric stuff, which is maybe tied to Apple Music in a bit, but still before, you know, literally before this year, they just relied on third-party lyrics providers to give them lyrics and the experience was not as good. And now the experience is better, but it also puts so much more work on their shoulders. Like all of that stuff, it's really interesting that it's all kind of happening at the same time. And maybe it's just a coincidence of timing, but maybe it's also like an indication of them actually taking on these kind of like web big data projects.
Yeah, I could just see the Steve Jobs answer now to the questions like why was that then and this is now? And it's like, well, we tried that on our own. We tried relying on partners and it didn't work well. So now we're doing it on our own.
Yeah, and they can do it in more private ways and all, you know, according to their policy, essentially.
Mm-hmm. That's true. So, yep. Let's talk about this, the bad news of Siri.
Yeah, speaking of privacy policy.
Yeah. There was an official Apple Newsroom press release about Siri and its grading program. And I think this is like the first time Apple has published on their website about this whole saga of The Guardian having the story about contractors listening to conversations that Siri's had and grading, you know, the quality of what's going on. So tell me about the Apple's official response to the world.
Yeah, because obviously they did a couple of press releases before, and we heard like 2 weeks ago they were halting the Siri grading.
But like press statements, so not on their website, but
yeah, not on TechCrunch,
etc.
Yeah. Just talking to third-party publications, essentially. And obviously at the time they said, "Oh, we're really sorry. We're going to pause Siri grading. We're halting it. We're not doing it until we review all our practices." And then this Newsroom post is essentially telling you the result of the review, and they apologize again. They explain, you know, what Siri grading is. So if you weren't clear, you can, there's like a plain English explanation for it now on the Apple website, which is nice. And they have like a dedicated support document for it as well. It's not just going to be disappeared off the bottom of the Newsroom, you know, in a month's time when all the products are out. There's like a dedicated support article for it. So that's great. And then they're kind of, oh, here's what we're doing now, is they're bringing Siri grading back in the fall at some point. So it's coming back later this year, and it will come back with the storage of voice recordings off by default, whereas before it was on by, where it was just on and you couldn't opt out at all. Now it's off by default and you can opt in. You'll be able to opt in the software to have your voice recording stored. And they said that they're going to do a better job at not letting people listen to inadvertent activations. So the cases where the HomePod or the phone thinks that you said the trigger words, but you actually didn't, they can do a better job at filtering those out so people don't actually hear stuff that they didn't intend to actually talk to Siri with as much. And they said that the people listening to these recordings will be Apple employees and presumably not third-party contractors from spread across the globe.
Which could mean hiring the contractors permanently.
Yeah, yeah, all the contractors are submitting their CVs now. Being like, yeah. Can we do it for you instead, officially?
But I like probably that, because that was one of the things I brought up that I felt it was just a weird thing. Is why is this one of the most sensitive things to happen at Apple being, you know, outsourced, and now it won't be?
Yeah, exactly. And I think this is a pretty good response. I'm not going to like applaud them from the rooftops. There are a few people on Twitter like, Apple's doing so much better than Amazon and Google because it's going to be opt-in, not opt-out. It's like, come on. Amazon and Google are not the benchmarks to be like congratulating you on. Like, the whole point of the Apple brand is they're supposed to be way beyond that already. Yeah. This was a bad situation where, and I don't think they were doing it maliciously. It's just one of those things they've had running for 7 years and no one ever really thought to like, you know, this doesn't really follow our modern day like approach to privacy. We should probably change this. Like, that just didn't happen until the PR Ferrari kicked up about it, and then they did essentially what everyone expected them to do, right? Like, it's not like they're going, because one interesting like corner case of this is that they will still be storing the textual transcript of what you said. So when you talk to Siri, obviously it gives you the text version of what you said. And regardless of whether you opt in or opt out to them storing the actual voice recordings, they're still going to restore the text version. So theoretically, you could still say something to your phone that's incriminating or personal, and a human could go and find that, an Apple employee can go and find that without you opting in, right? Because they just see the text version instead. But that's like a trade-off where Apple needs it for their data and they need to do improvements at some level. So they're not like all shiny, but it's definitely a much better situation to be in than they were you know, a month ago. One thing they didn't commit to in this newsroom post is that they're not saying they're going to offer like a portal where you can go and see your recordings, which is something that Alexa and the Google Assistant stuff do offer. Where you, and I think that's important, not really because it's like, oh, I want to manage my voice recordings on a case-by-case basis, but it's a good like way of being very transparent about what's exactly going on. Because if there's a setting screen where you can see like these voice recordings are recorded on our servers, stored by us, and you can delete them at any time and they'll be reviewed by, they may be reviewed by a human. Like when you have the Amazon or the Google products and you go and see those screens, you can immediately understand, you don't have to have any prior knowledge of how any of this works, but you can immediately understand, oh, this data exists, right? This recording of me from 6 months ago still exists on someone's server somewhere. Do I actually want that to be the case or not? And that's something that Apple is not going to do. In a perfect world, I think they should offer some portal like that just to give that extra level of transparency. But, you know, all in all, it's a perfectly fine response to, and a very predictable response to what we expected them to do.
Yeah, I think my biggest confusion around this whole story is that I believed that there was not a connection to your account to the voice recording. Like, I didn't care if my voice recording was out there, you know, not out there, but in there, to be graded, but that if it connects to my account for any period of time, then that's a little bit, you know, uncomfortable.
Yeah. It's kind of not connected to your account. They basically just make like a one way hash. So an anonymized identifier. Mm-hmm. So when it's stored on their servers, they can collate every recording from you into one group, but they don't know that that's Zach Hall. Right. From the data.
Unless they listen to the podcast.
Yeah. Yeah. Or if you talk to Siri and you say, you know, hello, I'm Zach Hall. Obviously, they're going to get information at that right. point. But in terms of the metadata that's stored with it, they're only getting a grouping identifier, essentially. That means that we can. So say if you pronounce something really funnily, mm-hmm. they can go back to their previous 6 months of recordings and find similar cases and build it together and mm-hmm. to improve the model. But they can't say, this is your email address, this is your phone number.
Siri, call me Benjamin Mayo. Okay, I fixed that problem now.
Problem solved.
Yeah, yeah. And even just back to the podcast transcripts and stuff, didn't you find examples of like where our podcast was transcribed and like
Happy Hour transcribed?
Yeah, sure. that's neat. It's just neat. I don't know. All right, let's talk about iOS 13.1.
Are you sure you said that right?
Yeah, it's so crazy. Like in our initial headline when you know this happened, we didn't know what was going on. Like no one did. So we had to say. Apple released its first iOS 13.1 beta, likely iOS 13 beta 9, assuming it was some typo or something, and it wasn't. And, you know, hindsight, okay. But, yeah. So tell me, if you can make sense of this, tell me what's going on.
Yeah, this is kind of weird. Like, obviously, iOS 13 got to beta 8, and there still might be a beta 9. Published in the future, we don't know yet. Like it's
I bet there's surely development inside, if not to the public, then at least inside. Not done.
Yeah, and then obviously this surprise release of 13.1 is interesting because it basically to me it shows that they want to get 13.1 out quicker than in a normal year, because in a normal year they wouldn't start beta testing a 13.1 release until after the major 0.0 was out, right?
Yeah.
Like normally the week after 12.0 comes out, they start beta testing 12.1. They haven't previously before seeded a 0.1 before the major 0.0 has come out. They have had cases before where they've been running simultaneous beta trains of multiple versions at the same time.
Like every June.
Yeah, like every June, yeah. Or even like... discounting the next version release. Like if you remember the Apple Watch in 2015, because the Apple Watch kind of software was in 8.3, there was a period where they were beta testing 8.2 and 8.3 at the same time, and they released betas on both tracks for both of them. Like them having 0.1 releases or 0.2 releases running simultaneously is not new. And when the 13.1 stuff came out, it became pretty clear that there wasn't like a shocking new feature in it, right? Like,
right.
It's essentially the same as the 13.0 beta trains, but they've added some of the features they took out back.
Plus iPad.
Yeah, we're not getting like a heads up on a feature that they hadn't announced yet.
Right.
So what's back? We've got automations are back in Shortcuts.
Mm-hmm. And that helps out Home app.
Yeah, that helps out Home. Yeah. You've got the...
Share ETA is back with Maps.
Yeah, is back in Maps. And that's a cool feature.
Has it improved? Like, I know from my experience with driving with CarPlay using iOS 13.1 beta, Share ETA now has an icon next to each person. If they're on the I think S13 beta, then they have a map icon next to the avatar. And if they're not, they have the messages icon. And I've even seen it be like a different icon for SMS. But the way that I'd always tested it working was it sent a text message that would update, or an iMessage that would update as you progress through your journey, if the ETA changed. But at least now it can the thing where it shares a live map of the contact. Is that different than ever before?
Before you could have it so in the Maps app, I don't think it shares live location. I think what it shows you is that, say, if you're both on iOS 13 and you share ETA to someone on iOS 13, the link opens in the Maps app natively, and it will have like your face and it will tell you your ETA, and it will show you your destination in the Maps app, so you could also get directions there. I don't believe it shows you currently where you are.
What's the play with that?
It's kind of like, you know, like on the bottom panel of the Maps app, while you're on the journey, it will show like your face and your ETA on there and that as well. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of like the extra integration you get versus if you're just on iOS 12, it can only send you messages, right? And it gives you the text updates through messages, or if you're on an Android phone, it sends you SMSs. But if you're both on iOS 13, that information is shown in the Maps app, and you get Maps notifications of changes, not just like filling up your texts, your iMessage streams.
Okay, well, I thought to play with that and see. I mean, it's misleading if it is that it shows your face at the point A, and then it doesn't change. So
yeah, at least when I tested it in like, and this was way back. This was like 13 beta 2. It would show up in Maps, but it would not show you your current location. Okay. It would only show you the route, essentially.
Yeah, we'll see and report back next week, I guess.
Yeah. But announced messages with Siri is not back.
Yeah, it's so strange. Like, I don't understand. That feature worked very well with AirPods, with Power Beats. The only complaint I had about it was that it doesn't work with the Apple Watch. So which is kind of an ideal situation for it to work, is if you're on an outdoor workout away from your phone. But it worked great at the gym.
Yeah, it worked good when I tested it as well. The iCloud features, which was like iCloud photo sharing and iCloud pinning, so you could always force a file to be localized and not offloaded, that is also not there in 13.1, even though it's still in Catalina, I believe.
But it jumped off Catalina today.
Okay, in beta 7. Catalina today. Yeah. Okay, so they've caught up. They've caught up now. Is there any other? I feel like there's one other feature they must have brought back. Oh, yeah, audio sharing, right? That's back.
Yeah, sharing your AirPods with somebody else. So that'll be a 13.1 feature, not a 13.0 feature, right?
Yeah.
And they've got some new stuff like the I don't think we've ever discussed the volume HUD changing on iOS 13, which is like Reddit's favorite topic. But it has changed once again in 13.1, which is like kind of a new thing. It'll show a glyph in the volume indicator for what device the audio is going to. Like, they've got icons for AirPods and Beats.
HomePods.
Yeah, HomePod, Beats. It's supposed to be CarPlay icon. So that's new.
Yeah, and then I think the communication limiting thing in screen time, where you could restrict which contacts someone can talk to, that was removed into the 13.0 train as well, and that's back in 13.1.
Is it back? I was thinking it was still missing.
Oh, no, that's one of the things that's still not back.
Yeah, still missing.
Yeah. But in general, 13.1 at the moment, it's the same as 13.0. And I would expect that. I think what's going to happen is 13.0 is going to ship when it ships, which will be like the week after the event. So if we're expecting the event on the 10th, it will come out, you know, the middle of the next week, and then the phones will ship on that Friday, and they're probably going to ship with 13.0, and then maybe there'll be like a day one update for 13.0.1, which is just like bug fixes, mm-hmm. right? And then 13.1. will be iterated on a few times and then maybe ship at the end of September. Because in previous years, we've seen the point ones come in like at the end of October, normally timed with the October event for like the iPads or whatever. But if they're starting the 13.1 train now, it seems pretty obvious they want to get it out faster than that. But it doesn't, if they only started betaing it this week, it doesn't seem like it'd be ready for the third week of September, which is what they need for the iPhone debut. So it still doesn't, I don't think, because some people on Twitter were guessing, oh, the day one patch will be 13.1. I don't think that's going to happen.
Me neither.
I think 13.0, either beta 8, which we've already seen, or there may be beta 9 come out, you know, next week or something that improves stability further. That'll be what will ship on the phones. And then this is quite common. They do like a 0.0.1 or 0.0.2 on the same day, which does some device-specific fixes. But 13.1 as it stands is probably not coming out until like the end of September at least.
I hadn't even considered that 13.1 would come sooner than like October or, you know, the usual time that because they're testing now, that means that they're going to release it sooner. That makes sense to me. We've had a lot of questions about this because it is confusing because it is different from the past. So there's a developer beta of 13.1 and there's a public beta now. And if you're on the 13 beta, then you go to update or you update automatically and it takes you to 13.1. For that reason, I don't think there'll be a beta 9 of 13 because you can't get to it. Like,
but that's exactly how 8.2 and 8.3 work, though. 8.2 came out, and if you went to 8.3, you couldn't get back to 8.2 unless you did like a restore with the firmware connected to iTunes. I think basically because the simultaneous trains are so rare, they've never bothered to set up like two profiles for it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just like, oh, because at the end of the day, right, these are meant to be for developers.
Yeah.
So
well, if you're a developer, not the public beta.
No, but this is all coming from the developer infrastructure, right?
Sure, yeah.
So if you're a developer and you're freaking out, oh, I need to get my app in day one, oh, big deal, you're going to have to flash with iTunes, right? Because you read all the warnings when you install it. This is meant to be for developers. So that if there is another 13 beta that comes out, maybe even a couple more before the like second week of September or whatever, then you might just have to flash using an IPSU download or whatever. It won't be available at OTA.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's like 100% they're not going to do another 13 beta.
Yeah, I don't think that they'll do well. I'm not sure what they'll do for the beta for users, but I definitely don't think they've looked at beta 8 and said this is what we're going to release. Yeah. I think internally they continue to fine tune that because I mean I don't feel like they've even done battery optimizations in these betas yet, like they do, you know, before releases where they're in testing mode, but then they optimize for performance and battery at the very end. And there are new betas for everything else. So I think Apple TV got a beta update. The Apple Watch definitely got a beta update. Catalin is behind, but it got an update today. So they're still doing other releases of that.
And sometimes they even do like GMs on event day. Like they'll say developers can now submit their apps using the GM versions of iOS and Xcode and stuff. Right. So it's not out of the question there'll be more 13 betas or the 13 beta 8 build is not what's shipping on the phones, right? Or what will be available for everyone to download on Wednesday. Mm-hmm. Whether it's going to be dramatically improved from what was on 13.0, that's a different situation. Because it's not like the 13.1 beta is super stable, right? It doesn't seem to be.
It's worse.
Yeah, it's almost worse. So it's not like, oh, their solution is we'll just release 13.1 as soon as possible and then all the bugs with 13.0 will be gone. Like, that's not where they're heading with this. 13.1 is bringing back some of the features they had to pull out for time reasons of 13.0, but the stability issues and the buggy issues are completely separate problem for them that they're dealing with.
Yeah, some bugs specific to 13.1. I've seen the messages app crash when you get to it by way of a notification, or notifications needing to be closed in some way besides the usual dismiss method. And then also, I think we both experienced this where the share sheet has no friends row anymore.
It's just blank. Shows like weird shadows and outlines, but there's not actually like people there.
Right. Yeah. So it's a weird thing. And I've also seen people ask when the new iPhone comes out and my 10S is on 13.1 beta and the 11 needs to be on 13 for a restore. Like, what will I do? And this has kind of happened before. I mean, if you upgrade like throughout the year or mid cycle, or, you know, this has been experienced before, even though this sort of thing for the 0.0 release has not been. But the answer is you either stop using a beta, and do a clean install, you know, and you just use your account to sign in without the backup and restore, or you set up your iPhone 11. you go through the process to get to the, you know, then you upgrade it to the beta, and then you can do a full restore. You know, you can actually restore your data. So you might get stuck on the beta train, and I've been looking forward to being off of it soon. but yeah, maybe it'll also discourage people that don't want to deal with the hassle of betas to not do it in the future.
Yeah, this is the, like, the peak of beta life at the moment.
Yeah.
What you sign up for.
What do you think about, you know, with iOS 12, there was the meeting that leaked by way of Axios, and then Bloomberg had some more reporting around it that was like, you know, we're going to halt all these features that we were planning for toward 12. They're going to be part of 13. And we've got this multi-year strategy for developing features so that we can maintain stability and have new features when they're ready, not whenever the time's up. This is like, you know, I think at the time we said this isn't a pattern yet until it becomes a pattern. You know, this could just be a one-year strategy. They've got to prove the record over time that this is a shift that makes a difference in the future. I can't say that shift a year ago is anything more than a one-year plan. Because this year, even though it's not chaos like a lot of people kind of see it to be, it also isn't.
It doesn't feel as good as iOS 12.
No, right? Yeah. It seems very in flux.
Yeah, obviously the multi-year plan thing was obviously through reporting, and Apple never said or promised that's what they were going to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
the way I kind of read it is that the iPad features, like the changes to the home screen, the changes to multitasking, I think that was the stuff that was on the multi-year schedule and not necessarily everything else that we see, if that makes sense. So some of the features like Share ETA or all the automation stuff, maybe that hasn't been developed for multiple years and they did just run out of time to get it done. And it
Because the layout of the dashboard view in CarPlay, that I think that's what was pointed to in reporting.
Yeah, that was one of the things they said had been delayed from 12. Yeah,
that's right. And that's here, and it's never been removed, and it works fine. But Share TA could be outside of that category, sure.
Yeah, and there's so much like foundational stuff as well that can get in the way of just getting these things stable. Whether it's all the work Apple has had to, all the engineers that have had to spend time getting Swift UI out the door, or you know, all of this stuff, right? That's most of it is not related to any specific feature. It's just under the hood changes that they're getting ready. Maybe they've diverted a lot of resources to AR glasses or something they're working on that's coming out soon. Like there's a lot of different factors that can appropriate to this. I think in summary, it's like 13 is going to ship and it's not going to be as stable as 12, but it's not like a dumpster fire that Twitter likes to make it out to be, in my opinion. That it isn't as stable. There are bugs here and there on the 13 betas that we saw, but it wasn't like, I didn't think it was anywhere out of the ordinary of like a normal year, like iOS 10, iOS 11. It felt like generally in line, and there's stuff that I don't like about it, and most of the things that I didn't like about it and features wise haven't been changed in 13.1 beta yet either, so it's kind of moot there too. But in terms of stability, it kind of felt roughly normal. And that's a disappointment if you're expecting the iOS 12 stability train to continue forever. But in terms of the longer view of iOS releases, you know, it's about normal.
Well, this is something I guess is more of a question for listeners. And it's that, so the 5S gets cut off at 13. It's stuck on 12, which is probably for the best.
And the 6s are gone.
And the 6, okay.
6 and 6 plus.
Yeah, it's pretty aggressive. Well, not really. But I wonder what it's like to run 13 beta on a 6. Like, is it that you lose
you
all...
Well, you can't run it on a 6.
A 6S. Is it that you lose all the progress you made from 12 and it feels more like 11 dead? Or is it that you feel like it's just as fast as 12 was and you get new features like dark mode?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Yeah. So it's curious. Because you could have a return of, don't do this update, it slows down your phone. if it is a backwards movement in terms of stability and speed and everything.
Yeah, and obviously I'm on iPhone 10, so it's not 10S, right, but it's still relatively new. But my complaints with 13 were not about speed, they were just kind of like bugs, right?
Sure.
Stuff didn't always work the right way. So they're kind of, you know, separate things, although obviously part of the iOS 11 meme was it was very buggy and there were problems and stuff, so... But in terms of performance, I think performance is okay, or you know, up to par, essentially. So I'm hoping that performance stuff is still the same, and it's just like the weird bugs that will get corrected. And then we'll have 0.1s that address some bugs, and then the 0.1 will come out maybe at the end of the month, then into September, and that'll address more. And then you know, by the time the one after that comes out, the bug situation to hopefully be resolved, and they can get onto more important things like fixing the home app group tiling and the text editing craziness and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, so if the 10's doing okay, that means that the 8 and 8 plus are doing okay, because that's how math works. There's a 9. But it's the 6S and the 7, and then also the iPads of those generations that you'd maybe be concerned about.
Yeah, we need to watch out for.
Yeah. Okay. Well, cool. Maybe some listeners will share what their experience with the beta or betas is like on those devices. Anything else on 13.1 and what we're going through here?
Yeah, I think that's about it. Obviously, the thing that's overhanging us at the moment is the event, right?
Yes.
We expect to be on the 10th, but Apple hasn't said it officially. It's very likely that the invites will be sent out tomorrow, after the day that we're recording. So we'll obviously cover that. But yeah, so we're kind of just in the holding period at the moment for the official announcement of the September event.
Yeah, so we're recording on Wednesday the 28th at 5:30 p.m. Eastern time. So we've expected all week long that Thursday would be, based on the past few years or several years, that this Thursday would be the time that Apple invites press that will attend the event and also just announces publicly that we're having an event. And you know, in past years, there have been reporting, I wouldn't even say like leaks, but just like reporting that Apple was planning an event on X day at X location. And we haven't had that so much lately.
Part of that's because it's now all done on campus.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But so we haven't had that stage lately. But at any rate, we by the time you're listening to this, you probably already know the status of the event. We don't. But next week we'll get to talk about that. Only thing I want to promote this week is my 9-to-5 Mac Watch Time podcast. So I've released episode 5 today as we record, and I'm planning on doing like 8 to 12 in total. So we're really getting through the first season, and it's with a fellow Brit, Mayo, Ian Blackburn, who is a 53-year-old father of 3 who had a sort of medical scare at in his 40s, and started diving into the world of fitness just to improve his life. And then the Apple Watch came out. And so he got to just use that as an accessory to kind of track what he's already doing, but then take it to the next level and kind of, you know, accept the challenge of, can the Apple Watch really do that? And so he's finished, 2 Ironman triathlons and, a number of marathons, I believe. And so it's really impressive. And he was so fun to talk to. With these podcasts, you know, with you, we've been doing this for 240 shows. But with Watch Time, I sometimes try and prep, you know, prepare guests, and we kind of do like a practice run, because, you know, as a guest,
you're people used to it.
Yeah, you might not be a podcaster. Ian was a natural. I was so happy with how it went. And, I love every episode of the show so far, but, Ian's is the latest episode. Go give it a listen if you haven't heard Watch Time. I think you'll like it. I'm super proud of the project, and I'm having a blast with it. So, give that a listen. With that being said, let's wrap up the show. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Apollo Zach Benjamin. You're on Twitter at
BZA Mayo.
And also follow 9to5 Mac on Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, Facebook, and 9to5mac.com. And if you have any email feedback for us, you can email us at happyhour@9to5mac.com. If you enjoy the show, please give us a rating and review in Apple Podcast or Overcast or wherever you hear this podcast. We really appreciate all the feedback we get. And we will be back next week. Bye, everybody.
Bye.